This is the podcast for Monday, January 14th, 2013, Theories of Knowledge. So my recorder lost power at the beginning of class, so just to recap, the Honors Program is accepting applications for spring 2013, and the deadline is January 30th. I have posted their website address in the social forum in the Moodle course.
We talk about the Gettier problem. It's a problem for knowledge. The traditional definition of knowledge is true justified belief. And a belief has to be true in that it corresponds with reality. The world actually is the way that the statement or belief describes. It is and is supported by objectively good reasons or evidence. It's justified, a justified belief. So, again, for a belief to be also knowledge, it has to have justification. But then there are these funny cases that Gettier thought up, one of which I give in the text. So this guy Carl in your class, and he's got this really cool car, Porsche, and you see him driving around, and he's like really flashy about it. He's kind of like, in your face, I own a Porsche. You call it slobs, you know. It's like, he's got so much money, what is that? Why isn't he going to Harvard? His parents seem to be well-heeled, or so what's the deal here? But, you know, you think, well, maybe he was a screw-up in high school, maybe for whatever reason. He's coming here to slum it at the community college, and you're like, boy, that sure is a nice car. But it turns out that Carl actually, he works at someplace which gives him access to cars, like a car wash or something, and he's like stealing the car in the lunch hour to show it around. And, you know, and then bring it back just in time. So this guy doesn't really own a Porsche. It's just an elaborate charade. And because he works at this car wash or what have you, he takes pictures of the car and you know, puts them in his wallet and shows them to people. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's my baby, and so on. And, you know, poor Carl, he suffers from low self-esteem. This is the only way he can get attention. He thinks it's going to get him girls and so on. And so it's a sort of elaborate charade. On the other hand, so on the basis of the evidence presented to you by Carl, any reasonable person would think that Carl owns a Porsche, right? You see him driving it around in the LCC parking lot. He shows you a picture of it in various, you know, stages of being clean and so on. You see Carl with two girls clad in bikinis, you know, standing in front of the car. He might even have like a phony registration that he shows you. Yeah, so all these things, right? Maybe there's a picture of him at the auto show, and maybe there's an auto show in town, and he, like, drove out to the auto show. You know, again, when he's supposed to be detailing the car, he drives it out to this auto show and poses with it, and his friend takes pictures. But it turns out that it's just, you know, this is all a sham. But still, it's a really convincing sham. So as a rational person, you should believe that Carl does indeed own a Porsche. But your belief is false. So it would be false, justified belief. Wouldn't count as knowledge because it's false. But on the other hand, suppose unbeknownst to you, somebody else in the class does own a Porsche. They're just like really quiet about it. And you have no reason whatsoever to believe that he owns a Porsche. So that's Brad. Brad's worried about, you know, the being tarred as one of the one percenters and class envy and, you know, all the commie lib LCC instructors trying to make you think that rich people are evil and stoking the fires of greed and envy and so on. He's worried it's going to get keyed or somebody's going to, like, you know, break in the windshield in a fit of anger as they're going off to their Occupy Wall Street protest. So he's like, I'm not going to bring that to the LCC parking lot. I might as well drive it down to Compton or something like that and park it on a street corner and walk away. So he's like, oh, that would be crazy. So he keeps it at home, you know, and he's kind of low-key about this money. So it turns out, yes, it's true someone in Philosophy 202 owns a Porsche, but your evidence for it is based on a misconception. You have a true belief someone in my class owns a Porsche. It's justified via Carl's charade. But it's only true by virtue of Brad's owning a Porsche as sort of like sort of a random happenstance, right? And it's totally unconnected with the evidence you have for your belief. So again, you get these kind of weird things. And all I'll say about this is if you go on to the University of Oregon and take a philosophy class, you know, you say, well, I learned at LCC that knowledge is true, justify a belief. And I want your professor to say, ah, that's the problem with these community colleges. They don't really teach you, you know, the whole story. So did you ever learn about the Gettier problem? So this is the Gettier problem. Is it a huge problem for the theory of knowledge? I think not really. There's like, again, you can read paper upon paper sort of trying to patch the holes in the true justified belief theory. And most philosophers will sort of hold on to that. If you hold on to the correspondence theory of truth, this theory of knowledge is truth justified belief makes sense, goes all the way back to Plato. There are funny little cases that make you scratch your head and think, okay, well, it's not that simple. Let's make it more complicated so it works. And you know, most people think this is an answerable challenge. So because it's a survey class, we don't have a chance to go into it in depth, but I just want you to be aware of that. And you can Google the Gettier problem if this really excites you. But I think for most people, they're like, okay, this is like kind of confusing and complex, and I want to keep it simple, true, justified belief, you know, good enough for government work. And this is a government institution. So questions or comments about the Gettier belief? Gettier problem? Sorry.
Wouldn't it, I mean, you said it's true because there's someone in your class who owns a Porsche, but wouldn't most people state the belief as, sorry, was it Carl?
Carl's the guy who's faking it.
Wouldn't most people state the belief as Carl owns a Porsche, in which case the belief would be false?
Okay, but so you have these two beliefs, right? You have this belief Carl owns a Porsche. But because you believe that, you also believe someone in my philosophy 202 class owns a Porsche. The one belief logically implies the other.
Is that assuming that we're in the philosophy 202 class?
What if
we just know Carl and we don't even know he's in the philosophy 202 class?
Well, then my part wouldn't work. But so let's assume you're in the class. Mm-hmm. Or you could say, you know, somebody's in, you know, someone in Borrowdale's philosophy 202 class owns a Porsche. And you see, like, Carl coming and going in the class, and so you know he's in the class or something.
Okay.
Or you work in the testing lab, and you saw his registration for the course. You know, what when he came in to take his test, what have you. So it's this kind of weird thing that you believe that Carl owns a Porsche, and so that logically implies a belief someone in my class owns a Porsche. And so that someone in my class owns a Porsche belief is true, but it's based on a misconception. But the belief we're talking about that you know is that you know someone in your class owns a Porsche. But why do you know it? Because you believe something false about Carl, which is accidentally true because of Brad. So again, it's just, so then people say, oh, well, what's going on here is the justification and the true belief have to sort of connect up in a certain way. Or it can't be based on a false belief. And people sort of go down the line and try to eliminate all these funny exceptions and try to patch it up. And I think they do a pretty good job of it. But again, we can't go into detail here. You can, you know, in graduate school, I remember reading these long papers where people would keep on trying to poke holes in this theory. And then here's the skeptical objection. And here's the answer to that. And here's another objection. Or here's why that one doesn't quite work. And there's a problem with that one. Try this one. And but these are sort of nitpicky, I think, tactical objections that you know, have answers and aren't insurmountable. So the Gettier problem is a problem for the traditional theory of knowledge accepted by most philosophers. Let's see. It's really important to know the difference between truth and justification. Truth is the way the world is, apart from any consciousness of it. Its truth is that which describes reality. And now, it may be that, you know, to have a statement or a belief, you need like a human being or some conscious mind around to make the statement or have the belief. But then we have this notion of a proposition, right? A proposition is that abstract thing which is true or false. Propositions can exist without any people. And so the proposition, the earth is round, you know, was true 4 billion years ago before there were any human beings, and it's true today. The earth is flat never was true. The earth is flat has always been false. Now, people who believed it might have had, you know, subjectively good reasons for believing it. They might have even, you know, maybe you can't blame them for believing it, but that belief was still false. Why? Because it didn't match up with reality. Any last questions about in terms of like true, false, belief, statement, proposition, correspondence theory of truth, relativist theory of truth, skepticism? Okay, let's move on to something more fun. These are all sort of basics. Now, we're going to come back to this, and I don't want to hear, like, true for me, true for you, or my reality, your reality, all these things that sort of get us confused. Save those for your class on postmodern, post-structuralist interpretation in your embodiment class at the University of Oregon. So for the purpose of this class, we're going to stick with sort of the traditional and, I think, true theories of the correspondence theory of truth and this theory of knowledge, because it's the foundation of all of philosophy, and it's only, you know, in the 19th and 20th century that people started to get confused about these things, and in my opinion, go in the wrong direction. Okay, let's. So. We're going to talk about today about Descartes' Meditations. This is a whole section on rationalism. And first, I thought we'd start out with the first rationalist. You had some pre-Socratic philosophers who were sort of rationalistic, like Parmenides. But Plato is the most well-known and I think first or popular rationalist. So, rationalism. Anybody who read ahead, or actually, I told you to get into chapter 2 tonight, read Meditation 1 or 2. What is rationalism? Yes, sir?
Knowledge comes primarily through reason.
Knowledge comes primarily through reason. Good. And how else might knowledge come? Yeah, so primarily through reason and not the senses. So the senses play a kind of secondary or minor role. They're not that important. Sometimes they mislead you. They get you confused. If you pay too much attention to the senses, according to rationalism, you'll go off in a wrong direction. And so we're going to look at Plato, and then we're going to look a lot at Descartes. So, and Plato's allegory of the cave.
Start out with that.
And I posted both these videos to the course if you want to see them again. Let's see. Oh, yeah.
Where are they?
So they're both in the class notes and podcast section of the course on Moodle.
I see it.
Playing in class here. Someone turn off the lights in the back there.
Turn them all off.
Yeah, go ahead and turn them all off. We got some light coming from the back there, and that's good. So down here. Oh, brief announcement. If you're interested in applying to the honors program for spring 13 term, I posted that in the social forum. And deadline's January 30th, so get those applications in. Looks good if you're transferring or want to get into a good four-year school or just are looking for another feather in your academic cap. And
posted that on
our page? So it's on, not there. So I'll post stuff like this from time to time in the social forum, honors program applications. And there's a link to the honors they have a web page where you can get more information, or you can just search in the lane site for honors. Okay, let me get back to where I am. By the way, if you're navigating the course, the little breadcrumbs thing at the top here should help you. You can get back to the main course page just by clicking on this up here. Oops, I'm in the wrong form. You can also hit the back button. So here's this class notes and podcasts. It's where things are archived. There we go.
Imagine prisoners that have spent their entire lives chained deep inside a cave. They have been chained so that they cannot see behind themselves, and they are forced to stare endlessly at the cave wall in front of them. Behind them, a fire is burning, and between the prisoners and the fire is a raised walkway. Now imagine that each day a menagerie of objects crosses the walkway. Animals and people carrying their wares to mummy. Their shapes create an intricate shadow play on the wall in front of the prisoners. This is the only world that the prisoners have ever known. The shadows and the echoes of unseen objects. Now, imagine that a prisoner was released. After some time adjusting to the blinding light, the freed prisoner will begin to experience the world outside the cave for the very first time. And it is like nothing he could have ever imagined. With his new perception of the world, the man will of course want to return to his friends to share his incredible discoveries. But the prisoners cannot recognize their old friend. He appears as all things do. His voice is a distorted echo, and his body is a grotesque shadow. They cannot understand his fantastic stories of the world outside of the cave. To them, it will never exist. This, of course, does not make the world outside of the cave any less real.
You have these prisoners, and they're chained up, and in front of them there's a wall, and this wall shows all these sort of distorted shadows that are being cast from fire, and then there's this walkway. The perspective on this is totally skewed, but. And there's people walking across here, and you get like a camels, and it's like a Loch Ness monster. And, you know, people carrying stuff. And so all this stuff is casting these shadows. And this guy is looking at this, and all he sees is this kind of crazy distorted stuff on the cave wall. And
this is the prisoner. These are the objects. Here's the light in the cave, the fire.
And then in the story, he's freed and goes out and sees the real world, and he's sort of dazzled at first, and he kind of gets used to it. And then he runs back into the cave to try to tell his friends, but they think he's nuts, and he tries to describe to them what he's discovered, but they can't understand what he's saying. He sounds like a madman. Actually, in Plato's original telling of the story in the in Plato's Republic, he says, you know, if he keeps on, you know, with his friends telling about this crazy stuff, eventually they're going to set on him and kill him because they don't want to hear it anymore. So, what do you think? What is this? This is an allegory. It's a story which has a point, and where each part of the story represent something in the real world. So what do you think this allegory is about? Any thoughts? Yeah.
I believe some things must be operational, although it's from part of one if somebody tries to tell you differently.
You have to pump up the volume a bit. You get a low voice and you're way in the back.
If somebody tries to tell you something that's different from something that you believe from your childhood, say, just, for example, believe Christianity, eventually you just get tired of them saying it, you just won't believe something no matter what they tell you.
Right, so there's something in here about belief, that belief seems to be something that we want to hold on to, and if you're raised with certain belief, you accept it as true, and it's really hard to change your belief. You know, we're creatures of habit, and we return to the old familiar beliefs of our youth and tend to cling to them. Unless, you know, hit with a sort of big experience, like being dragged out of our cave, so to speak. Yes, Olive.
It seems like it has something to do with a priori and a posteriori knowledge. The prisoner who's coming back has sense experience, so that's a posteriori. Mm-hmm. And we can't seem to convince these prisoners who have not had that same experience that it's true and real.
Yeah, so and here actually, you know, I think Plato, we have these two terms, a priori, a posteriori. A priori is knowledge that comes through reason, through pure reason, logic, mathematics, basic concepts. And then a posteriori knowledge is knowledge of particular things, like you see a table here and a chair here, and you see shapes and colors and things. And so often, you know, rationalists will say these a priori ideas, these are universals. These are things which are eternal truths. They're truths about the world in general, and those are things you can sort of hang your hat on. They're stable. They're objective, they're real, and the particulars have to do with your sensations, and they're always changing, and they're not really reliable. Sometimes your senses make a mistake. And so there's this distinction between, you know, inside the cave, you might say this is like a posteriori. And I put knowledge in quotes here, because Plato doesn't really consider these sorts of things to be knowledge. So I'm putting this in scare quotes, meaning that Plato wouldn't consider it to be true knowledge. And then it's sense experience of, you know, of the material world. And then, you know, outside the cave, it's outside the cave, it's the true world, and he thinks this is a priori knowledge, and it's sort of knowledge of the real world. And this is the real world as intuitive through reason. I'm getting a little ahead of myself. There's a couple other people with the hands up. Over by the brick wall, do you have something to say?
with the glasses?
I think it means that you have to have some sort of proof to change someone's belief. Like, you can't just say, oh, this is the way the world really is. If you don't have any way to prove it, they have no reason to believe it.
Yeah, when he comes in, he tries to explain it to them, and they're just, they haven't experienced it for themselves. What do you think, like, that experience, what might that be?
Mind-blowing.
Yeah, what, like, what might it represent, like, you know, in the real world, that kind of, that the, what would, being dragged outside the cave, what would that, what might that represent? That's close. How about, like, you know, having, like, the first, yeah, transformation, but what kind of transformation?
Transformation.
Well, you think about Plato, right? Plato's this philosopher. He's got this new groundbreaking theory of the forms, and he's like, you know, the first, you know, one of the first real philosophers. So he's thinking about this as this sort of, you know, philosophy. You're learning to use your reason in an independent way, thinking for yourself, thinking, hey, here's what everybody else believes, but is it true? Wondering whether the traditional wisdom is actually wisdom, whether what everyone around you believes is actually true, or whether everybody might have this kind of shared delusion.
Maybe it's humbling because he has to accept that what he believes isn't true.
Yeah, and that's, I suppose, you know, when he's dragged out there, he accepts the world as it is. Maybe it's humbling, and he can realize, okay, I was wrong. And he doesn't, you know, he doesn't run back to the cave and chain himself back up or something like that. That might be sort of, you know, fear, the way people kind of retreat to their beliefs. But his companions don't understand him, and they kind of like it in the cave there because that's sort of all they know. And eventually they get tired of him, and they kill him because they don't want to hear it. And that's actually, I think, in the story, an allusion to Socrates, who was executed by the city-state of Athens for asking too many questions, basically, and causing trouble thereby. So we have the cave, which is sort of the world of the status quo, the ordinary world of sensation. And sort of like not really thinking for yourself, not thinking independently, not thinking philosophically, but just sort of going with the flow, experiencing things, not really thinking about them too much. And then when you start to think philosophically, you get this sort of aha experience, and you realize, oh no, there's more to life than just sort of these sensations I'm having. There are these eternal truths and concepts with which to understand reality, and that's to, you know, embrace the philosophical worldview and to be enlightened. And so the sun represents, actually, Plato says the sun represents the form of the good or goodness or the idea of goodness. And then, you know, the light is sort of his reason. And the real world, according to Plato, is conceptual. It's these sort of eternal concepts or ideas which are more real than the material world. Now, this is something that, you know, is sort of hard to wrap your mind around in the 21st century. But Plato's idea is that ideas are real, and they're more real than material objects. And in fact, ideas are what give material objects their whatever reality they have. So he thinks about ideas as being sort of like a rock. And then if a rock casts a shadow, that shadow would be the material object. Whereas we tend to think about ideas as being kind of ethereal and abstract and sort of ghostly representations of real objects. Plato thinks it's the other way around. And so as a rationalist, you can see if he thinks the true reality is ideas and concepts and the material world is less real, then knowledge is going to be about these eternal concepts. Now, you don't necessarily have to buy into Plato's metaphysics about ideas are real in order to see that maybe, you know, there's just going, if you just went on your senses, how would you see the world if you just You're just going on purely on sensation. Yeah.
So it's kind of like if you were trying to find somewhere to sit down, there's the idea of a chair, a place for you to sit. Mm-hmm. It could be anything, but we materialize the shape that we want when really you can sit on a log, and that would be a chair, the same idea.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to use our sensations and just walk through the world, we would just find the first place that looks comfortable, and that would be our seat, our chair.
Right, it takes your mind to see, to sort of abstract the idea, you know, this log is good for sitting on because it's a certain height. But it's also got sort of a rough texture, and the ants, you know, make you itch and so on. You think, and you know, and then you can't really lean back. If you like lean back and relax, you fall off the log backwards. So you're thinking, but you know, sometimes I like sitting on a log, but also I like leaning up against a tree. And so when I sit down at the base of a tree, I can bend my back against the tree and it sort of holds me up. But then my legs fall asleep, and I don't like that. So if I could like have the same experience of leaning against a tree while sitting down, and also by sitting on like something raised, and you get the idea of making a chair. And that's something where your mind puts together these two different experiences to form an abstract concept of the chair. And that's not something you can do with sensation. With sensation, you have the level of consciousness of an animal. You're just like, oh, I'm experiencing hunger or thirst, you're happy or sad. But it's not. There's no sort of forward-thinking, abstract thinking going on. So, let's see, what else about the cave? Is there any other parts of the cave? These are supposed to be like material objects, matter or material objects. And Plato thinks that material objects are like shadows, and that the perception of material objects, which is like sensation, is like that. And sensation distorts the world. It makes the world look other than it is. And to understand the true world, you need to use your reason. You need to think abstractly. You need to think logically. And you need to chain together these concepts in certain ways. You need to understand definitions of things. You need to analyze the meanings of words, like what we were doing the first week with truth and knowledge and belief and proposition and so on. And once you start doing that, then you have something that can make sense of your experience. What people do, Plato thinks, is they do it backwards. They sort of have all these experiences and never really put them together. Or if they do put them together, they let the experience mold their ideas rather than starting with the ideas and using those to organize their experience. And the rationalists say you need to start with logic, with the ideas, with the concepts, and use that to understand your senses and to understand the world. Not the other way around.
Are basically the opposite of what Plato thinks?
No, the rationalists are what Plato thinks.
Oh.
So it's the rationalists think you need to use reason and logic to guide your thinking. And the senses, maybe they play some minor role, but they're not really important. And in order to understand what sensation is and what it means, you have to use your reason and use concepts and definitions and build a system to sort of make sense of it. Whereas later on we'll see the empiricists say it's the exact opposite, that what you need to do is start out with these particular sensations and then sort of organize them in a certain way, and then that's going to produce knowledge. And reason just is sort of this mix and match process where you take a group of sensations and sort of put them together to form knowledge. The rationalists say that doesn't really work, that you have to start out with the concept in the first place in order to do any organizing whatsoever, and the senses are just going to take you off in the wrong direction. So that's rationalism in a nutshell. And the allegory of the cave, again, emphasizing reason over the senses. Sense experience is misleading. It's sort of a thinking about material objects. Plato calls uses this Greek word that means something like shadow thinking. So you're seeing shadows, you're thinking about shadows. If you're trying to reason about shadows, all you're going to get is just stuff about, you're going to get distorted ideas, distorted concepts, if you try to start your reasoning with shadows. What you need to do is intuit the true forms, you know, based on concepts. And you know, this makes a certain amount of sense. What might be some concepts that you could never learn through having experiences?
Mathematics.
Yeah, mathematics, right? Do you think, now maybe like you learn your rote, like your times tables and your addition and subtraction, maybe by rote. But it's something that you wouldn't be able to learn unless it was already something in here that was able to pick it up. Yeah.
Anything symbolic, such as like writing, mm-hmm. or even the fact that hedonism might not just necessarily be the best way to go.
Yeah, that might like sort of values and morality or something. That yeah. might be another example. So think about like learning mathematics. Do you like to learn the 2 and 2 is 4? Do you say, okay, well, see, I have 2 objects here, and I have 2 objects here, and you separate. I'm gonna count them 1, 2. I'm gonna count these 1, 2. And now I'm gonna do an experiment. Put them all together. 1, 2, 3, 4. Oh, it worked. 2 and 2 is 4, right? But, you know, is that just one experiment? Maybe I should do some other experiments. It's like, oh, look, I got 2 objects here, and I got 2 objects here, bring them together, 1, 2, 3, 4. Nobody ever does that experiment, because they, as soon as you understand the concept of two-ness, the concept of addition, and the concept of four, you see that those concepts sort of go together. Like, a triangle has 3 sides. Once you know what a triangle is, and once you know what the concept of 3 is, and once you understand what a side is of a figure, you know a triangle is a 3-sided figure. And the rationalists will say, look, here's what an empiricist will do. An empiricist is a person who thinks knowledge comes from the senses. And they think, oh, you have to go out in the world and look at stuff and look at shapes and colors, and you'll get knowledge. And an empiricist will say, you know, is a triangle a 3-sided figure? Well, let's find out.
I'll just draw some triangles here so I can have something to look at. Okay, I got some triangles here, and I'm going to count the sides. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Oh, that one worked. 1, 2, 3. Yep. 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm. It's looking pretty good so far. 1, 2, 3.
Maybe I should draw some more triangles just to be sure. Right. Well, that's silly, because in order to draw those triangles, what do I have to know?
How to do it.
How many sides there are, right? Or if I'm going out the world trying to find some triangles that I didn't draw, I'm looking at very triangles in this room. Very thin triangular. You
think that's how, which kind of knowledge?
So an empiricist who thinks that knowledge comes from the senses would do something ridiculous like this. He would like see, oh well, does a triangle have 3 sides? I don't know, I better look at some triangles and count the sides, and then I'll come to a empirical generalization from my senses about how many sides triangles have. And the rationalist says, look, these concepts, they're innate to your mind. There's something you have to start out with in order to even recognize anything as a triangle. And there's all sorts of these concepts, concepts of equality, concepts of addition, subtraction, multiplication, the concepts of like a set of objects, the concept of greater than, lesser than, equal to, you know, all those things are things you start out with. They aren't things that you can learn just by looking at different colors and shapes or having certain sensations or hearing certain sounds. They're innate to your mind. And this is what Plato would say. And Plato would say, that's where knowledge comes from. And all these colors and shapes and sounds and things and the sensations of hunger and thirst and you know, sounds, it's really, you know, and your emotions, all that stuff distracts you from the truth, and it's not going to lead you in the right direction. It's only when you coolly, calmly, and objectively consider abstract concepts, you'll get to the truth about the world. So that the rationalist emphasizes a priori reasoning, which is reasoning about things that are always true, thinking about things which have nothing to do with experience.
Right. A priori.
And Descartes has a similar attack here. he says that a priori reasoning is very important. Senses is not that important. Yeah.
How do rationalists address the issue of the first time you learn something, you are learning it through your senses?
Yeah.
Well,
when you're in kindergarten, you learn that a triangle has three sides because you can see it and count it and feel it.
Do I address that? Well, it's kind of like it's the idea of becoming a metaphorical symbol in your mind. That does take perception in your senses, but the way that you connect the symbols together in your mind is less of your senses and more of your own rational reasoning. Because you can look at it and say and see a shape, and then you may already know how to count to three, and you'll see that it has three sides, and then eventually somebody will say, that's a triangle. And you're taking the reasoning and mixing it together kind of with your perception of what people are calling it, and that's how you make that metaphorical symbol of the idea of three sides with the perception of what we're calling it, the triangle.
Yeah, those chalk marks, they're just sort of, you know, prodding your mind to remember what's already there. Somebody else had their hand up way in the back. You got to pump up the volume way up, project from the diaphragm.
It's a concept that's universal across a lot of different civilizations and through different languages, and I think that what you learn with your senses is just this visual representation of the concept. You're just using it to like assign something to a meaning in your head that you know that three is three.
Yeah, so it's kind of these mathematical concepts are, you know, something that are universal, and you know, triangle, there's a triangle in Japanese, it's just called something different, right? But you know, you look at a geometry textbook in Japan, it's pretty much the same as the ones in the U.S., the ones in Germany, and everywhere else. Yeah.
And there's some cultures that don't really use numerical systems. They have words for one or a couple or many or few, but they still use shapes that we use. And when they engineer, they still are using, you know, proper shapes with proper measurement without having the knowledge of the number three or the concept of three.
Yeah, think about a plant. So you have like a seed and you put it in the ground and you add some water to it. Now, where does a plant come from? Does a plant come from the water and the soil? Or are all the structures necessary to make that seed turn to plant there in that little seed? Right? It's not the flower and the stem and all the different parts of the plant. You're not like adding the content of the plant when you're pouring the water on, and the content of that plant and its shape and the way it's going to turn out and the colors it's going to have and so on isn't coming from the soil either. It's coming from that seed. And all you need is the right conditions to bring out those qualities in the plant. And as long as you have the right conditions or the right stimuli, the plant's going to grow to be what it's supposed to be. And so in the same way, you know, sensations can kind of prod and poke our memory, and we might need certain conditions to learn things, but really we're just bringing out what's already there in the structures of our mind, according to the rationalists. And Plato even says all knowledge is really recollection, that these eternal ideas and concepts are there in our mind as innate ideas. And Descartes has a similar view. That we have these innate ideas, that they're already there. It's just that we might need sort of some poking and prodding to bring them out, and sometimes that, you know, takes the form of sense experience.
So we'll talk a little bit more about rationalism later, but I'd like to go through a similar exercise, I suppose you might call this also an allegory. This is from The Matrix. Let's see.
At last. Welcome, Neo.
Oops.
I have a new fit.
Remember what I said the first day?
I didn't turn on the projector or pull down the screen. And nobody told me.
Okay, turn around the projector, pull down the screen. Also, when we're done, if somebody that's sitting over by the light switch could turn on the light switch, not now, but after we're done here, I'd appreciate it too, so I don't have to keep on walking back there. And if you don't want to man the light switch, don't sit near it. If you'd like to sit if you'd like to man the light switch, you know, plant yourself there next class. Okay. By the way, if you watch this again on Moodle, it'll give you the root blue pill, red pill choice and take you to some wacky video about the esoteric hidden truth about the universe, and you'll see like the eye of Horus on the back of the dollar bill, and it'll go into some wacky conspiracy theories. So I'm not endorsing any of the material in the esoteric agenda, but this is the best clip I could find on YouTube.
Guest, I am Morpheus.
It's an honor to meet you.
No, the honor is mine. Please come, sit. I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole.
You can see that.
I can see it in your eyes. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he's expecting to wake up. Ironically, this is not far from the truth. Do you believe in fate, Neo?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't like the idea that I'm not in control of my life.
I know exactly what you mean. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life. That there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there. Like a splinter in your mind. Driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Hatred.
Do you want to know what it is? The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. Even now, in this very room. You can see it when you look out your window or when you turn on your television. You can feel it when you go to work, when you go to church, when you pay your taxes. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
What truth?
That you are a slave, Neo. Like everyone else, you were born into bondage, born into a prison that you cannot smell or taste or touch. A prison for your mind. Unfortunately, no one can be told what the Matrix is. You have to see it for yourself. This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. Remember, offering is the truth, nothing more.
Good marking lights, please. Yeah, so if you, the red pill, I'm sure where the blue pill takes you to. I wonder if it takes you to the same thing. It actually looks different.
Your voice is
now I'm curious. Bambi or something. Oh, the Wizard of Oz. What is this?
It's a strange little
picture. Oh, okay.
Is this the blue pill?
This is the blue pill, so they maybe it takes you to another wacky conspiracy video. I don't know, I'll have to look later. I thought it would tell me up front. Okay, so so what are some parallels between that and the allegory of the cave?
The idea of being a prisoner.
Yeah, so this is the idea of the matrix. So this idea of in the cave.
Prisoner,
right?
A prisoner of your mind, or there's you're a prisoner, and that your mind's in a prison.
Mm-hmm. Truth and belief are can be separate.
Again, just go back to the truth and belief. So, I think that maybe a better way of saying that might be that that most of what you believe is false. Or that many of the things you think are true are actually may not be.
I mean, don't you think that the message of, as far as just the cave one, I was thinking just is that what you believe isn't necessarily the truth. I mean, the truth, that kind of seemed like one of the ideas they were trying to get across, that just because you believe it doesn't make it true. I mean, the ending statement was just because they remain in the cave doesn't make the world outside the cave any different, or just because they believe. Something.
Because they don't believe in the world outside
the
cave.
Doesn't make it any different.
Doesn't make it any less real. Yeah. So I just wanted you, when you say truth and belief are different, I can't remember exactly what you said, but it made it seem like if you believe something that then it's me or me. If you believe something that sort of implies it's not true. Or
no, not that. Just okay. That because you believe something, it doesn't necessarily mean it's true.
Okay, good. Yeah, I like that. So, So maybe most of your beliefs about the world may be false. And this is the kind of the skeptical challenge here, skepticism. And what else was similar?
The choice to either remain ignorant of the truth or to accept every reality.
Yeah, so the choice to either break, I'll just put break free.
The guy was like dragged out of the cave and just handed to him.
Yeah, I suppose. He could have gone back. That's a good point about the prisoner actually dragged out. I'm trying to remember if in the original allegory, if he actually breaks out or if they took liberties with the story and the guy escapes. I seem to remember the story that he escapes. Yeah.
So like freedom versus happiness, almost?
Yeah, that's something, and that's something we'll talk about later in the course. That's not really present, I think, in the play. Well, I don't know if that's really present in the play, for example.
The happiness would be ignorance, essentially. Like, you're just happy with your beliefs, whether or not they're true. And then freedom is, like, choosing truth, whether or not you like it.
Maybe, like, the harsh truth of the going into the light. Yeah. So there's, in the allegory of the cave, when the guy first gets out there, he's kind of disoriented. The light hurts his eyes. It's a sort of unpleasant experience to be shocked and to see this whole other world out there, and it's not a pleasant experience. And then when he goes back and tries to tell his friends and they don't believe him, that's not pleasant either. And so a person might say, well, it'd be better to take the blue pill, right? It'd be better to live a life of blissful ignorance. Yeah.
There's also the idea of a deceiver, because the somebody that's imprisoning mm-hmm. the prisoners, and also in the Matrix, the humans are imprisoned.
Deceiver, good. And we see in Descartes, we have this idea of the arch deceiver comes up in meditation too. And something else I can't remember what it was. Oh, yeah, later in The Matrix, there's this character named, what's his name, Cypher, played by Joe Pantoliano. And he's like, hey, I like The Matrix. You know, I know it's a delusion, but it's my, you know, it's a pretty good delusion. It beats living in the real world. And he actually ends up becoming the sort of Judas-type character because he wants to keep on living in the Matrix even though it's all a lie. And he kind of represents this idea that ignorance is bliss and that it's better just to go along with what everybody else believes and not try to think too much. Keep your head down and you'll have a happy life. You start thinking about the meaning of life and whether, you know, and things like justice, and you start having ideals, and pretty soon your life gets tough and rough, and nobody likes you, and your friends think you're crazy, and they don't want to hear it anymore. Or you end up like Socrates, right? You end up dead. If you push it too much, you end up becoming a martyr. Let's see. Other parallels between the two? So there's something in The Matrix too about independent thought. I like that where Neo said what truth instead of like true for who, right? He's in like a relativist saying when he says that. And when at the end when Morpheus says, well, I only have to offer the truth, you know, he doesn't say, well, what do you mean the truth? There is no such thing. So in the story, there is this, you know, there is a truth. It's just that everyone has had the wool pulled over their eyes and they believe something that's false, except for this sort of select few who, you know the truth. Although there's one case, if I had to criticize Neo for his answers, what do you think? Can you think of an answer he gave that I would like think, he shouldn't have said that? About some of the things he said. What did he say when he was asked if he believed in fate?
No.
Yeah, why didn't he believe in fate? What was his reason?
He doesn't like the idea of not being in control of his destiny.
Yeah, is that a good reason to not believe in something? Well, think about does the fact that you like something have anything to do with whether it's true or not?
No,
right? It's just he wants to believe something that gives him comfort. So that was a bad answer. But the rest of the stuff was good. And he's, you know, he's on his journey. But I don't know if the one would have said that. Right? So maybe I do a little rewrite on The Matrix. I think next time we'll just start out with Meditations 1 and 2, Descartes, and wondering, you know, what if life is all a dream, and what if there's an arch deceiver who's out to pull the wool over our eyes, much like The Matrix or in this, the allegory of the cave. We'll pick up with that on Wednesday.